On Monday, President George Bush spoke before the Polish legislature. He said, "Poland is not alone. The U.S. stands ready to help you as you help yourselves." It was the first joint session of the legislature since Solidarity's victory last month in the Polish elections. It's a remarkable contrast to 1981, when the Solidarity union movement was outlawed, martial law was declared, and Lech Wałęsa and about 6,000 other union members were arrested. It was in between these momentous events that my guest Michael Kaufman covered Poland for the New York Times. He says there were few newsworthy events from 1984 to 1987 when he lived in Warsaw. The real story had moved underground, along with much of Polish society. His new book is about Poland's clandestine resistance movement of the 1980s and how it endured. The book is called Mad Dreams, Saving Graces, Poland, a Nation in Conspiracy. Kaufman had formerly covered Africa, India, and Canada for the Times, but he had a more personal relationship with Poland. His parents were Polish emigres. Most of his Jewish relatives who stayed in Poland were killed in the Holocaust. Kaufman's father was one of the founders of the Polish Communist Party and was arrested and sentenced in 1929. Kaufman told me why his father was imprisoned.
Being a member of an illegal party which has as its goal the overthrow of, I think, established order. There is a very funny part in the book where my father comes to visit me in Poland. I'm now a correspondent. He's 86 years old. He returns after 50 years, and he hopes to see the children of some of his old cellmates who are, among them, Adam Michnik, who is the most articulate champion of Solidarity. And Adam is, of course, in jail at the time. And he asks Adam's girlfriend, Basha, what he might be charged with. And she says, chapter 2 of something or other, which is the establishment of... And then he recites the law, because it's the same law, only he says, then it was communists, now it's Solidarity.
Well, it's interesting, too, by the time he left Poland, he'd been expelled from the party.
Yes, thank goodness. he was in jail. He had been for his sins, he was a precocious 26-year-old general secretary of the Communist Party of the Western Ukraine, although he wasn't Ukrainian. And he was serving a 4-year sentence under party discipline. And midway through that sentence, with 2 years left to serve, he was expelled for sins of Polish patriotic deviation. And he at that time, the party and party discipline meant everything to him. So he committed suicide. He slashed his wrists and throat. He was rescued, put into a cell. And in that cell, his cellmate was Michnik's father. And that's sort of that's a minor thread in the book, but it gives me my legitimacy because I returned to Poland knowing this legend. I learned of my father's past. I grew up in New York. And the legacy that he bestowed upon me was one of... I thank him for it at the end of the book. I say I thank him for infecting me with romantic prejudices. But in adolescence, it was very difficult to... he set for me a standard of unattainable grace that involved hunger strikes and resistance and arrests and a very romantic legend. And I must confess that when I was 14 and 15, I in my heart wondered how would I ever find out how good I was if no one ever pulled me off a trolley car and put a gun to my head and asked me to betray friends or something of that sort. And in New York, that kind of thing didn't happen then.
Well, did that happen to you in Poland?
Not in Poland. There was a similar atmosphere of resistance, of cops and robbers, of good guys, bad guys, of being... I mean, it's rather remarkable. The people who... Adam Michnik, who I smuggled a letter in. I arrived in Poland and I smuggled a letter into him. He was then in jail and said, I don't know if it means anything to you, but I am here as the New York Times correspondent. He sent word to me out of jail. Now, I must confess that it rather surprised me that Poland was a police state, but it was a rather sloppy police state, and it didn't take too much ingenuity to move messages in and out of jail. But he messaged me saying, I'm delighted that you're here. I know exactly who you are. My father had told me about your father, and I welcome you. And then 4 or 5 months later, he was out in an amnesty, and we became friends, and he led me into this conspiratorial world that then dominated. Now, I might add that today, Adam is a member of parliament. He's the editor of the Solidarity newspaper, the only free newspaper in the communist bloc, and the people who he introduced me to, many of whom I met when they were wearing wigs and disguising themselves, and we would go through very arduous paths so that I would avoid those who might be following me. They, too, are now members of parliament. It's remarkable.
Well, I think this leads us to one of the observations that you open your book with, which was that it was hard for you to report on Poland without striking the right tone of absurdity. Mm-hmm. What are some of the other situations that you witnessed as a reporter that required an absurd tone to really describe them in full?
Well, almost any one of them. I talk early on of watching these. Solidarity would skulk out at night. Young boys would skulk out and paint that. Remember that very characteristic lettering that Solidarity used. Mm-hmm. So they would scrawl these red insignia on the walls, and then there was an anti-graffiti mob, which was the state would use, which would come out, or also in early morning, and I'd watch as they painted yellow signs over the red sign, just sort of daubed it with yellow paint, but they kept to the contours of that first S. And I then thought, well, wait a minute, this could be, maybe there's a semiotic shortcut, because everybody in the world knew what those yellow signs hid. And it was as if the state itself was calling attention to, they were erasing Solidarity, but you knew that what was underneath the yellow paint, so it was another symbol. That was one. But others were, I used to know a young woman who got a job for the summer washing windshields at gas stations. And I said, oh, that's terrible. You got to sit there and the fumes are so bad. And she said, no, it's great. She said, I make 150,000 zlotys, and that's three times as much as my father, who's a university professor. And he's been a university professor 20 years. There were these anomalies. There was no value, didn't mean anything. Work didn't mean anything. An hour's work, I used to know a woman who earned too much, and she didn't have anything to spend it on. So every Friday, she was a house, she cleaned houses for people who had money coming from abroad. So her income was very high, much higher than say the director of a bank or something like that. It was just a lot of money. And every Friday, she'd go out and buy rugs, and just ordinary rugs, whatever rugs there were. And she had a little house built behind her home, and she had it floor-to-ceiling stacked with rugs. And when I asked her why, she said, well, someday I'm going to have to leave something to my children, and this is all there is. They're just constant topsy-turvy world where work had... Oh, once I heard a guy on the radio driving along, the minister of finance or something, and he was asked by somebody, he said, when are you going to stamp out the black market? And he said, black market, my God, man, he said, if it wasn't for that, we wouldn't know what anything was worth.
Let me reintroduce you. My guest is New York Times reporter Michael Kaufman, and he covered Poland from 1984 to 87 when Solidarity was forced underground. His new book is called Mad Dreams, Saving Graces, Poland, a Nation in Conspiracy. When you got to Poland, did you realize that there was such a flourishing underground, both politically and culturally?
I knew there was. The extent of it I didn't know, and I didn't fully appreciate the way it's almost genetically encoded in the Poles. I mean, you have to understand that in 1795, Poland disappeared as an entity and reemerged 123 years later in 1918. But for generation after generation have taken their turns at the barricades, and in one form or another. Sometimes it would be romantic poetry, exile. Sometimes it was uprisings, and that lasted right through World War II. And so that part of it was rather remarkable, that a nation that had been raised on these legends, just as I had my legend, they had theirs. I remember talking to Jacek Kuron, who is another patriarch of resistance and Solidarity, also a member of parliament now, and I was telling him about the burden I bore as a child of a man whose legend I absorbed, and he said, I know exactly how you feel. I was a 7-year-old boy in World War II, and my deepest and most abiding thought at the time was, I hope this war doesn't end before I have a chance to conspire in it. And when he says to his father, I said, how did your father react to that kind of... He said, all I can remember my father telling me is, don't smoke. It's going to hurt you when you go to jail.
It'll cost you.
It'll cost you. And he did smoke, and it did cost him. 9 years. Yeah.
There was a popular book in the underground in Poland called The Small Conspirator. It was mm-hmm. a manual for clandestine activity. An interesting piece of advice in there. Remember the church as an open house. It's also open to the police.
Right. What happened at this point, and this is the remarkable story of Solidarity, which really, I'm sometimes surprised how people miss it, that except for Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King, this is the third successful use of nonviolence on a massive scale. And what was particularly remarkable was it's not in the Polish character. The Polish character is just to take up swords, have some impossible, heroic, but quixotic uprising, which you are against all odds, and in which you are defeated, and which generates great poetry and a great national myth. But my book begins with five guys who get away when martial law is imposed, and they're hiding. They don't know what to do. They don't have contact with each other. They're sort of split. They know they have to do something. And the suggestions range from sabotaging the armies, going to terror. What do you do to resist a state? And what emerges is this notion of, wait a minute, let's just stimulate those to do whatever they want to do. So that if somebody wants to publish a newspaper, let them. If somebody wants to put out a theatrical group or meet in a church or whatever, let them do that. And it was in that context that The Little Conspirator was published. It showed people how to do these things, how to operate mimeograph machines or printing presses or meet each other. Or they had mailboxes, how to make contact, and also how to deal with the police when you are caught, and how not to talk to anybody, the police. And then there was another wonderful suggestion, I remember, said that when you go to jail, learn not to be tiresome. You have to decompress when you're in jail to spare your colleagues. The same kind of energy that is wonderful in freedom becomes very oppressive in prison. So it was that kind of instructions, which I think now ultimately we see that they've prevailed.
Can you give us a sense of how the political dissidents and cultural dissidents survived underground and managed to keep up with their work?
Well, the simple answer is that they had a lot of help, that the nation was in conspiracy, that this encoding process, for example, early on, the kids from the National Academy of Dramatic Art, who were in the period when Solidarity was free, had been swept up in that elan and in that enthusiasm. Now they there's a clampdown. Some of them have gone into prison or being held in detention. Others are free. And those who are free decide, well, they will, and they steal the makeup from the theaters. And they make the makeup and makeup artist available to those leaders who are wandering around and hiding, who become very accomplished at wearing costumes. And Zbigniew Bujak, when he returns from Gdańsk, the dragnet comes. He is one of the five who gets away. He's smart enough to stay up there for 5 days or 6 days. But when he finally comes back to Warsaw, he's wearing the uniform of a railway conductor and glasses that he doesn't need, and he remains at liberty for 5 years running an underground civilization.
So a lot of people had dual lives, their official lives and their official jobs, and then they would take some of the tools of that job and use that for their underground life.
There were some of those. There were some who, others who had only an underground life, who the leaders hid out. They used to move apartments every 2 weeks. There was a bureau that was set up to do nothing but find apartments. They would look for apartments for these people. They liked big buildings. They didn't like big buildings with many entrances, so that there was a security bureau. They, over the 5 years of their underground existence, became technically expert. And it was odd because, again, what had been imprinted in their minds, as I spoke to them, were the experiences of their parents, which was a different kind of conspiracy when the Nazis were in Poland, when you took up arms or when you hid out in basements or did sabotage. This was a new kind of conspiracy that their children were now experimenting with.
Solidarity was restored to legal status in April, and They now have control of the upper house and parliament in Poland. What's your opinion of why the party is allowing this to happen?
Well, the party had no option. I finished my book a year ago, and in a sense, my last chapter predicts that there is no other alternative except for the authorities to reckon with ideas they could not squelch, and to deal with, as they did in the round table, with people who do, in fact, have the closest thing to a national mandate. The party in Poland, I think the interesting thing is that Poland has the most aberrant communist party of all communist states. It is the most aberrant communist nation of all communist states, and that's for a variety of reasons. But certainly communism has declined furthest and fastest and most dramatically there than anywhere else. For one thing, the state is 98% Catholic. For second thing is this tradition of resistance and defiance and uprisings that I've talked about. So the simple answer is, again, I quote Adam Michnik, who says that this is not socialism with a human face. This is communism with some teeth knocked out. And that process begins at least since 1956, probably goes back further than that. And the party was just so weak. You have in Poland a Communist Party led by a general. Now, that's not supposed to happen under communism. Generals are supposed to serve the party, not lead it. The alternative is very South American, and it's the sin in the communist world. This is known as the sin of Bonapartism. But they had no recourse except to throw in the general, because the party itself was so weak. And it was weak for a number of reasons, but the most of which was that nobody but the most corrupt, the most cynical, and the most incompetent people were joining it, or had joined it for, you know, it's a kind of country where someone was much more likely to admit to having broken wind at a dinner party than to admit that he was a member of the party. It was just in decline. And so they had no choice but to deal with these, with a group, and that group happened to be Solidarity.
Now that Solidarity is represented in government, do you think that it will remain an alternative to the Communist Party, or do you think it will somehow be co-opted by it?
Well, it won't be co-opted by it, but it cannot remain both a labor union, which after all has to represent the interests of workers, and a political party, which after all at some point will have to deal with closing down ineffective enterprises. And I think everybody I know within Solidarity expects it to split into, if the democratic processes continue, if the Soviet Union does not capsize, if Gorbachev doesn't capsize, then I think what we can expect is that the Solidarity in Parliament, that bloc, will split into normal other kinds of political parties, ranging from Christian Democratic to Social Democratic to maybe Greens, and it'll be like a normal country. That'll take some time. And I think that's one of the reasons why Mr. Wałęsa, Lech Wałęsa, has elected to not seek public office, but remain a sort of outside the structures, but the preeminent moral force of Solidarity.
Poland is in pretty bad economic straits right now. How much of an effect do you think the Solidarity parliament members can have in rescuing Poland from its economic problems?
Well, that's the key. That was their clout. And I think it's their premise, it's sort of my premise too, that the stability of Europe to a large extent depends upon the stability of Poland. There's Poland, lies in the heart of the continent. Three times in this century, the continent has been reorganized around Poland. 1918, three empires collapse. Where they meet is where Poles live, and Poland reemerges. The interim period, we have 18 years, that's another period. Then comes the war, where the two totalitarian powers of the century rip Poland apart and make it the epicenter of agony. And then finally, in 1945, Poland becomes the largest nation in Europe to be consigned unwillingly to the hegemony of a foreign power. Now, a new kind of Poland is emerging. And if, in fact, this premise is right, a new kind of Europe is emerging. Less divided prospects for some kind of post-Yalta agreements, not agreements, but consensus of a of a united, more united Poland. And if that is right, then it's also clear that the Poland poses a threat of destabilizing all of these dreams and these images of a united Poland, because it could become a behavioral sink. It is much too weak and too poor to provide stability by itself. And if that's so, then that effort has to come from outside. Well, the U.S. does not have the funds, does not have money anymore for a kind of Marshall Plan undertaking. But the Germans do. The Italians and the French might want to. And I think there is now at least a feeling that in Germany, in the Soviet Union, and in the United States, there are rather significant forces who all would like to see Poland prosper as a kind of buffer. And that simply wasn't true even 2 years ago. If things were bad there, that made it a drain on the Soviets, that made it good for us. So something is emerging here, whether the will and the money will be found, but I certainly think there's a possibility of a consortium, of an effort, an international effort to help Poland rectify itself. There was a very good piece by George Soros in the Washington Post last week where he made one point. He says things are so bad there that it would not take very much money to make an enormous difference.
Mm-hmm. One last question, and I've only left just a few seconds for you to answer this, so let me apologize in advance, but you've seen in Poland people who've been above ground forced underground, and then the reverse happening. Mm-hmm. Do you think the chances are good that Solidarity will remain a legitimate organization in Poland?
Oh, it will be a legitimate organization in Poland, and that's not even that important. It'll be a historical force, and it is a historical force and has been. So that's its legitimacy.